It's time to wake to sleep with the number one sleep authority, Sleep Science Today, and Sleep Better Tonight. It's time to wake to sleep with the number one sleep authority, Sleep Science Today, and Sleep Better Tonight.
Welcome to Sleep Science Today. This is the show where we talk about sleep and the science behind sleep, what's actually going on in your body and what's actually going on in sleep treatments. I'm your host, Andrew Kolsky. Today, we are talking with Dr. Kelly Dardeen, and she works a lot with first responders. So, Dr. Dardeen, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, we actually have not had a show talking about first responders before. We've talked a lot about athletes and other things, but not first responders. So this is going to be a lot of new information for us. Tell us a little bit about yourself. How did you get into treating first responders and what types of work do you do?
Yeah, well, I'm a former first responder, so I did that work for about 8 years. Right when I turned 18, I was on the track to pre-med and things like that and wanted some real life experience. So I took a EMT class and started working full time on an ambulance and then took paramedic training and started that procedure. Did that for about a couple of years, and then got into graduate school, decided I want to go more in the mental health route. And so it was about a 20-year gap. And then I actually stumbled into working with first responders. We were out in Salt Lake City at the time, and I was working in a brain disorders neuroscience clinic out there and ended up working with some first responders that had been in a helicopter crash, and they had some neurological deficits and things going on from that. And so that kind of started that journey, and I learned that I had a good ability to connect with them, probably because of shared experiences, and my husband's a former first responder and things like that. So once we moved back to where we're at now, I started working with a lot of our local agencies, and that has spread over time to where that's really all we work with now.
Wow. Okay. And that's, you know, great that you're coming from where they're coming from, so you have a better understanding.
Yeah. It's a very unique environment, right? Not very many people work in an environment where, you know, they get exposed to that amount of trauma and that amount of negative things that are going on in the world. And it definitely takes a toll on your psyche and on your sleep.
Mm-hmm. So just to clarify for the audience, when you're talking about first responders, to give us the types of jobs that covers.
Sure. We work with primarily police, fire, EMS, dispatchers, and correctional facilities. So typically those are the ones that we primarily interface with.
Okay, great, great. So tell us then, what types of work do you do? Obviously, one of the things you work on is sleep, but give us a broad picture of the types of things that come into your office.
Yeah, primarily we are doing trauma, post-traumatic exposure work. So working through critical incidents with agencies when they have incidents that involve death or significant bodily injury. We work with our agencies when they have an employee injured, when they, you know, have things going on from a bureaucratic stress standpoint. Most of our police agencies are pretty large and have a lot of bureaucracy involved, and that can be very stressful for the individuals. So we see a lot of shift work issues, sleep disruption, and then traumatic exposure is probably the second biggest. And then we see the repercussions that come from that in people's day-to-day lives. So oftentimes there's disruption in primary relationships. Oftentimes there are higher rates of alcohol use. We see quite a bit of depression, anxiety, and panic type symptoms that come from those chronic exposures and how those stress chemicals build up in your body over time.
Wow. Okay. Yeah, I can imagine. Obviously, stress would be a very large component of any of these types of jobs. they don't need the bureaucratic stress on top of it, unfortunately.
They don't. But unfortunately, it exists at a pretty high level. In the last several years, even the bureaucratic stress is outpacing occupational exposure stress, which is to me just a phenomenon that should not be happening. Right. Their stress should come from the fact that they just faced down something difficult or saw something that most people will never see, not because of things going on within their admin or whatnot. So it's definitely a challenge to work with the population.
Right. Right. Wow. So share with us then, specifically the types of, because we're talking about sleep, the types of sleep disorders that you might see?
We see a lot of insomnia. Typically, sleep is one of the first things to become disrupted after stress. So it's one of the early indicators that something is developing. And the hard part is for us in our, you know, population, oftentimes you're going to have predictable reactions after a traumatic experience, and sleep disruption is one of those. So it's not necessarily indicative of a larger problem unless it doesn't revert back to normal within a week or so. And for us, obviously, that's usually when we get involved, is when it hasn't reverted back to normal. So we definitely see the shifted sleep phases because of shift work. We see insomnia quite a bit. We still do have folks that have sleep apnea, need a help adjusting to the equipment that's needed to sleep with that disorder. We do see some nightmare, sort of parasomnias and things like that as well.
Wow. Yeah. I didn't even think about the nightmare part. I guess that would be part of this.
Yeah.
Wow. So, all right. So let's break these down a little bit. Insomnia, the first one you were talking about. Now, typically, From my experience in my practice, I deal with chronic insomnia. And chronic insomnia, the person has had it at least 3 months, is one of the elements. So you've got people who you said, you know, they may have it for a week and then they come and see you. So what is the, for you in your experience, what is the difference, if any, between what's going on with someone with insomnia for a week and you're seeing them versus someone who's had it for 3 months or more? Are there differences in what you do and what they experience? Give us a good picture of that.
Yeah, well, and it depends on what's the cause. So for oftentimes, insomnia by nature is behavioral. It's a pattern that develops. And the things that we often do to try to cope with the poor sleep makes that insomnia chronic in nature. And so we're basically just catching it before it gets to that level. But it does depend on the trigger. If somebody has just been sleeping poorly and it's due to general stress, not necessarily a traumatic incident or a traumatic exposure, oftentimes there's some simple behavioral things that we can put in place quickly to change that. If it's already crossed that line into becoming more chronic because they've put some adaptive things in place that have not been helpful, then we're going to treat it a little bit differently. Both of those, though, are going to be behavioral in nature and focused on how you work with your sleep system. You know, specifically if there's traumatic content, processing that traumatic content can help alleviate and get rid of the sleep disorder. It just depends on what the trigger is that's causing it.
Mm-hmm. So from the simplest side, let's assume trauma is not in the picture for a second.
Yeah.
And someone comes in and they say, man, over the last week, I just haven't been able to sleep well, and it just isn't getting any better. What are some of the initial things you might actually do to put in place?
Yeah. So we have to do a good sleep assessment, have them track it for a week, show us, you know, when they're actually waking up, what that looks like. You know, are we having trouble getting to sleep, staying asleep, or waking too early, right? Because those are different approaches depending on what's going on. And some of them have only one type, some of them have all three going on. Once we know kind of where the primary disruption is, then we can plan some interventions. The simplest ones that we often work on is waking up at the same time every day, especially with our guys, because we see a lot of night shifters for obvious reasons, and they tend to flip to a day shift when they're off. So on their days off, if they've got especially a family or children in school, they flip their night shift and they try to sleep during the day. Your brain does not know what to do if you are not waking at the same time every day. And so oftentimes it's a simple, let's bring in the spouse. Let's talk about quality of life. Do we want dad or mom that's engaged in the family and can do things? Or do we want overtired, cranky mom or dad because they're able to get people where they need to go, but they're not really able to engage in the family life? So sometimes it's a quality issue, right? And we talk about what can we tolerate? Can we carve out a sleep window that can stick with a night schedule, but still allow them to do things with the family? And so sometimes it's just more about how we want the quality of our family to look so that we can carve out something that works for them. But it's that wake time that really is our anchor point to how our body sleeps.
Hmm. I wonder if you have like an example you can share with us, because here's what I'm thinking to myself. If somebody is working the night shift, and now you said, you know, they want to spend time with the family, obviously family's awake during the day, probably.
Right.
And if they're trying to stick with the same schedule, that really impacts the quality of life. What type of compromises do you actually see people being able to do?
Yeah. And I think especially when your kids are younger, it's a little bit easier than when they're in that like late elementary to middle school age, because oftentimes, you know, that looks a little bit different. But if it's possible, then, you know, I would encourage most of them, they've got to figure out when their sleep window can be. And so we've had several officers that are working like a straight night shift. So that'd be, you know, 6 p to 6A. And so they get off at 6 a.m. and if you've got young children at home, usually young children are up that time of the day. And so oftentimes we encourage them to stay up and be with their family in the morning. And if they can at least make it through, you know, 10, 11 a.m., then they can go to bed at that point and sleep through, you know, the middle of the day when children are usually napping or there's other things going on where they're not going to miss out on as much. And then, you know, they're up by, you know, 4 or 5 p.m. in order to spend some time with the family before they go back on that shift. Most of our police shifts are, you know, they'll do 2 days on, 2 12-hour shifts, and then be off for 2 days, and then be on for 3 12-hour shifts and off 3 days. So it's a constantly rotating model. So it does require, I think, a lot more planning. But again, it just kind of depends on those phases of life. It would be the opposite if they had older children where they're not going to be up in the first thing in the morning. Then we would say, get home, get to bed as quickly as you can, and then get your sleep chunk on your days off or your days on shift as quickly as possible. Get that we usually try to shoot for 5 to 6 hours of solid sleep. And then you're up and, you know, you're up by noon potentially, and you have the rest of the day with your family. So it's just a matter of trying to figure out where's the wiggle room.
Right. Yeah. I'm thinking to myself, when do I ever get to the grocery store? When do I get to the hardware store? You know, those types of things, because they're not open at night when I'm awake.
Yep, they're not. And I think that's the challenge, especially in rural areas. We service a lot of rural areas and nothing's open at night. And so it definitely requires, you know, communication with their partner, communication with the family members to figure out, you know, how are some of those things going to work? Who's going to be up with them, which oftentimes ends up being their shift mates, right? That's going to be up overnight. And they're often sometimes doing things together, even if it's just a virtual connection, so that they can stay awake on their schedule, on their days off, and then, you know, giving them a better work-life balance if at all possible.
Right, right. Wow. Okay. So for those of you listening to the show, this gives you a window into what else is going on in that policeman's life or that ambulance driver or whoever the first responder may be. They're not just, you know, there for you, but, you know, they have a real life attached to it.
And they're trying to fit their life in around those things. And these are also, I think, the hard part is like most police agencies are either 10 or 12-hour shifts. Fire agencies are usually 24-hour shifts. So then you have a whole other, you know, area where they're coming home off shift, being up potentially for 24 hours, and they have to recoup some sleep, but it doesn't look the same because it's not always the same amount of sleep that they're missing, or, you know, those schedules look quite different. So it definitely, a lot of our work goes around just figuring out what kind of a schedule can be sustainable and work in the long term. And some of them just flat out say, I'm not going to do that. I need to flip. Okay, well, we're going to give you two schedules, a schedule to follow when you're on shift and a schedule to follow when you're flipping. And you got to flip the same way every time, if at all possible. The fewer times you are changing how you sleep, the better you will sleep. It just might take longer for your brain to adjust to that pattern, and your sleep quality still might be a little less than it would be if you were not flipping. But it's definitely a balancing act.
Wow. Well, yeah, I can see a lot of the stressors already. Well, let's do this. We need to take our first break, but when we come back, I'd love to follow up a little bit more on the trauma issue that we haven't talked about yet. So Stay tuned, and we'll be back in just a minute on Sleep Science Today.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
Be sure to visit sleepsciencetoday.com for access to all of our channels and special offers.
Sleep Science Today. And sleep better tonight.
All right. We're back on Sleep Science Today. I'm your host, Andrew Kolsky. We are talking with Dr. Kelly Dardeen about first responders and sleep. So before the break, I said we're going to talk about trauma and how that impacts sleep. So can you tell us what are the typical, I mean, I'm sure we can imagine some, but what are the typical types of trauma the first responders deal with and how do you deal with it when it comes to sleep?
I'll say the most consistent way that we see agencies utilizing us as a company is when there's a child-related death. So our first responders see a lot of child deaths. They are always impacted by those, no matter what the reasoning behind it is. Those are extremely difficult. Keep in mind, too, our police officers, our firefighters, our EMS folks, they're family members, too, right? They oftentimes have children either the same ages or near ages of the children that they're treating. And these can leave really, really long-lasting impacts for them. So oftentimes they will have, you know, a lot of difficulty sleeping, especially in that 48-hour window after the exposure to what they've seen. For some, it will resolve a little bit after that and they'll get back to getting some regular sleep. But for others, that's where, you know, the triggering event is that then causes them to have a more chronic style of insomnia. Potentially, sometimes they have very vivid nightmares of that particular event, depending again on did they, you know, our rural agencies, there's another added issue with that. They may know the victim. They may know the family. They may live next door. And now they're responding. And now they've had to deal with the fact that this is a traumatic incident. It's a child death and it's somebody that they know or care about. So these are all things that can add up to influence how our brain responds, right? Typically, the first few symptoms of disruption that we will see are sleep disruptions. Our sleep system is fairly sensitive to those types of emotional upheavals. You may have noticed if you've had a big breakup or a sudden loss in your life, you notice that your sleep shifts significantly. Well, our first responders are particularly doing that almost every shift for some of them. So you can imagine, you know, they've got to have some really good skills to offset that.
Wow. So. Somebody comes in, they're having sleeping problems. You identify that one of the reasons is trauma. What types of things are available for you to do to help them?
Yeah, so there's several techniques that we can use that are trauma-based. We can use, you know, what's called cognitive processing therapy. It's a way to go through and process the trauma from a different perspective, dig out problematic things associated with it, help those resolve. We have some techniques. One of them is called EMDR. So it's eye movement, desensitization and reprocessing. That's something as well that can help the brain settle. The brain works very differently when it's in a fight or flight response. And how it works protects the first responder in the moment, but it causes difficulties after that, just because it's working in, I would kind of describe it as a safe mode. So your brain is behaving in a way to try to protect you, but in essence, after the fact, that the way it's trying to protect you gets in the way a little bit. So oftentimes, if we work them through that process and keep them from avoiding it, avoidance is one of those things that can make trauma worse over time. So we work on helping them be able to process it in a safe setting, in an environment that's supportive and not going to get them in trouble or in danger or any of those things. And oftentimes, that's enough to get it out of their mind so that they can sleep. We then combine that with some behavioral techniques, right? What we talked about a little bit earlier, waking up at the same time every day, making sure you have a sleep routine that you're following, those sorts of things. And then if there are specific nightmares that don't go away with trauma-based treatment, there are some additional things we can do for the nightmares specifically that oftentimes will help those ease in their severity and oftentimes, you know, the repetition that they get from that.
Wow. Whew. I'm hearing and feeling all the stress that they must deal with. So let's talk about another piece of this that you've talked a little bit about, but I want to dive in a little bit more, which is the concept of shift work. And here's, I'm going to give you a couple questions thrown in together because they all may be relevant to the answer. So you've talked about the types of shifts that firefighters have, like 24-hour shifts, and police have the 12-hour shifts and all these things. Not just first responders, but you got a lot of shift workers out there that work in factories or work in airports or whatever it may be.
Yeah.
So there's shift work sleep disorder, which I'm going to ask you to tell us a little bit more about. But the other part of that question is also, why do they schedule 24-hour shifts? Why don't they schedule 8-hour shifts? I never understood that. Educate me.
Honestly, that's a staffing issue for most agencies, because especially our smaller agencies simply don't have enough staff to cover 8-hour shifts, because now you're scheduling potentially, you know, if you've got, you have 8 positions you need to fill, that's 24 people in a day, and they may not have that many on their roster. So oftentimes it becomes both a budgeting and a employee a number issue versus anything else. So that's, I think, the hard part is our staffing ratios are not where they need to be in most first responder agencies. There's sort of been a phenomenon for the last several years where they're all chronically understaffed. So then we're also adding in overtime and mandatory overtime and all of those things. And it's really hard to keep a regular sleep schedule when you're working a day shift and then you're pulling in overtime on nights, or you're pulling in overtime on those that might have a mid shift. So I think that's the hard part, is a lot of that comes down to money and how they can afford to staff what they need to cover. That makes it very challenging.
Yeah, I can't imagine if I were a firefighter and I was up for 22 hours already and now I get called to a fire, I'm sure my adrenaline kicks in, but I'm sure I also must be really tired and not thinking as sharply.
And there's unfortunately some good research to show that that level of sleep deprivation is just as impairing as operating a vehicle while intoxicated. And so we have good science to show that we should not be allowing our officers and our first responders, our EMS folks, even our correctional facilities, you know, that run on those 24-hour shifts. We should not be letting people work when they're sleep deprived, and we should be putting things in place to help protect that. The bottom line, though, is they just don't have enough people. And so they default to, we still have to cover all of these things. And that's been a debate for a while from the mental health side of, you know, clinicians that are working with first responders saying, we can't keep doing this and we need more people. And the reverse side saying, yeah, show us the money, figure out how to do it. And I mean, I wish I could. I wish we could fix those things. That makes it very difficult. But I think that goes all the way up through admin into governments and our city governments that are planning budgets, knowing that, you know, we are putting our whole communities at risk if we're not taking care of our first responders.
Right, right. Wow. Yeah, complicated issues. Boy. So let's get into some of the technicalities, though. What is shift work sleep disorder?
So oftentimes, you know, your brain sleeps a certain way, and I don't have a way to do a good visual, but the way we sleep is actually driven by the rising and setting of the sun. So your brain has two drives that are responsible for sleep. The sleep drive, which basically kicks in from the moment you wake up, and it tries to put you back to sleep. So as soon as you wake up, your brain is getting a signal to go back to sleep. But that signal is really weak because you just satisfied that drive. But the farther out you get from the last time you slept, the stronger that pull towards sleep gets. Conversely, on the other side of that, there is a opposing drive that regulates your sleep drive, and that is your circadian rhythm. That one is basically managed by the rising and setting of the sun. So from the time you get up, you're also getting an alerting signal to stay awake. So you're getting a sleep signal and an alerting signal at the same time. But that alerting signal, especially in the early morning when you just woke up, doesn't have to work very hard because your sleep drive isn't working very hard. But as the day goes on, both the signals pulling you towards sleep and the signals trying to keep you awake get stronger. And so what happens is throughout the day, then once the sun sets, that alerting drive is triggered to shut off. Well, what are you going to do if you're asleep if you're a worker that works at night, and unfortunately, you have to be up at night, you are every single time, every day, working against your brain's natural sleep system. And it's going to cause problems. It means that the way your brain secretes chemicals that also help you go to sleep when that drive shuts off, they don't happen. They get disrupted. They don't work the same way. And so now we've got this, you know, mess of, you know, trying to force ourselves to sleep when our brain is screaming at us that we should be awake, or vice versa. And it can be very challenging. So pretty much any business that runs on a 24-hour clock where they have different shifts, they're running into this issue. And the worst one is ones that switch. If you are straight nights, you can do a better job of regulating than if you are day shift for 2 or 3 months, mid shift for 2 or 3 months, night shift for 2 or 3 months. It's actually better to just do one or the other than to rotate. But unfortunately, you know, there are still organizations and industry that function that way.
Right. Wow. So if somebody had a shift work sleep disorder, what would it look like? What type of symptoms would they have?
I think they become very, they have that chronic insomnia where they can't sleep very much of the time, no matter when they're trying to sleep. Their quality of sleep becomes very, very poor. And then we see it translate into other symptoms like irritability and difficulty with attention and focus and all of those things. But primarily, I think, you know, their body is not allowing them to sleep when they want to sleep, which involves so much frustration. Most of us can recall having a sleepless night where we just toss and turn, and it doesn't matter how much we sleep, we don't feel rested. These guys could sleep 12, 14, 16 hours and still feel not rested at all because their quality of sleep is messed up. They're never getting into that deep sleep and that restorative sleep. So their brain is really not even clocking that they're getting any sleep. And so that sleep deprivation just worsens and worsens and worsens. And that takes a toll on their physical health as well. Their risk of strokes and things like that go way up when they're sleeping that poorly.
Wow. The last thing anybody wants is a first responder who's sleepy and tired and exhausted and stressed, yeah, and then has to perform because we're right. talking about life-saving situations.
Right. And primarily their job is to make decisions, right? They come in and problem solve. Well, half the time, you know, their sleep is very poor. They may not be able to make any of those. Or again, you may have noticed when you get really, really sleepy, you get really, really cranky, you can't control your emotions as well. Like, our sleep center controls our metabolism, it controls our body temperature, it controls our mood. So if we're not sleeping well, all of those things become more difficult. So now we've got officers or firefighters coming into a situation where they have to figure out, you know, or a EMS person coming in and looking at somebody with a variety of symptoms and trying to come at a diagnosis and an appropriate treatment plan. And maybe we miss something big because our brain isn't functioning the way we need it to function in that moment.
Mm-hmm. Wow. Wow. All right. Well, so I want to sort of shift a little bit into talking more about treatments, about medications, about options, those types of things. You know, what do we do with these issues? But before we do that, we do need to take our second break. So stay tuned, and we'll be back in just a minute on Sleep Science Today.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
Be sure to visit sleepsciencetoday.com for access to all of our channels and special offers.
Sleep Science Today. And sleep better tonight.
All right. Welcome back. This is Sleep Science Today. I'm your host, Andrew Kolsky. We're talking with Dr. Kelly Dardeen about first responders and sleep. So we've talked about some of the disorders that we might see. What do we do about it? Is this something that we just have some quick, you know, take a pill and you're good? Or what do we do?
Sadly, no. But the treatments are actually not long in the grand scheme of things. When we think about mental health treatment, sometimes that looks like, you know, people might be in treatment or in therapy for years, months to years. And that's not obviously a quick turnaround. But this is quite different. A lot of our sleep treatments can be effective in as little as 6 sessions. So that's a 6-week time frame for most people to see a complete reversal in insomnia. For our guys that we're treating trauma-based, we can even see sleep improvement in about 2 to 3 weeks. The good news is that most sleep disorders are behavioral. So doing a few simple behavioral things can help. The difficulty is they're not going to help immediately. So if you start working on some of those, we use CBTI, cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia. It's a very structured framework. And typically, by the time we get to the second or third session, people can already see the changes and they see improvement, and that helps them stay motivated to maintain in treatment. And in fact, that's kind of what we do with all our first responders. Whatever they're coming in for, we do an assessment right off the bat of, hey, how's your sleep? Because we know it's so foundational to everything else. And the treatment relatively, compared to other things, is relatively quick. And so once we get them to see that if they change their behavior, they can see positive benefits, it ties them in and helps them be a little more comfortable to do other types of work as well. Because, hey, I made this change, I can see an improvement. And we use that as a foundational piece to get them motivated to do the rest of the work.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So you're, you know, you talk about the fact that sleep is a behavioral process and treatments based on behavior are effective and not very long. But, you know, when we think of sort of cocktail party conversation outside of the first responder world, let's say it's just sort of general cocktail party. Oftentimes you hear so many people talking about, oh, I have to have my sleeping pill. My doctor gives me my sleep med, and without that, I can't sleep at all. So what's going on there?
Yeah, well, the hard part is that because the sleep system is a closed system, we don't need medications to sleep. But because of how people think about sleep, anything that you use for sleep becomes psychologically dependent. So we believe that we need it to sleep. And so guess what? Our brain tells us that. And obviously the sleep medicine industry is a $1 billion industry. But the reality is no sleep medication is indicated for use more than 2 weeks at a time. So we're not meant to be using these things long term. What I tell our first responders is absolutely, if you need a over-the-counter sleep aid or things like that for a day or two after a traumatic incident, if it's, your brain's not resetting, that's okay. If you are seeing that become more chronic in nature, then no, we want to let our body do its work naturally. And so we start that by saying, get your sleep system worked out. What time are you going to wake up? Waking up at the same time every day helps reset that. You know, if let's say one of our guys was, our firemen like to nap. They just do. It's a safety nap. The hard part, though, is that if you get up in the morning, let's say you get up at 7 a.m. and you don't go to bed till 11 p.m., that's how many hours that your sleep drive has steadily built, right? So you should be pretty sleepy by 11 p.m. If you get up at 7 a.m., you're busy during the day, and then you take a nap from 1 to 3 p.m., and then you're up from 3 to 11, your sleep drive is not going to be as powerful to put you to sleep at 11 p.m. because it's only been building since 3 p.m. instead of 7 a.m. Mm-hmm. So that's the hard part, is helping them understand, like, truly, yes, if you need a safety nap, 30 minutes or less is what we focus on. Get that power nap, get that, that gives you the benefits without detracting from that night's sleep. But some of them don't want to hear that because that's such a cultural thing in the firehouse, that we take the safety nap and we do these things and that's their slower time. And I understand that from a perspective, but again, sometimes those conversations are, what's going to benefit you more? Using that time in a different way, getting a little bit of rest, and then getting back in so that you can sleep better at night, or potentially not doing that and then struggling with your sleep in general for however long. Right. So it is hard sometimes to get them to understand like how that works and how does it work? You know, how do we recoup the sleep we may have lost if we truly are up for a 24-hour shift? Then how do we sleep to recoup that and not disrupt our sleep for the next few days? And sometimes that takes a lot of wiggling.
Huh. So in your experience, are different agencies, let me see how to ask this question. In terms of screening people for sleep issues, in terms of educating people about sleep issues, all the things we're talking about here. Now, they come into you, it sounds like, once they have a sleep issue. But is there any work being done that you're aware of on the front end?
Yeah, we try. This is, again, one of those hard things that we try, especially with our police agencies and fire agencies, to get in and do sleep education. So we try to get into every agency at least once a year to do wellness training. I think it's pretty well known at this point that our first responder agencies are in crisis. They're losing people. The rates of suicidality have increased in every first responder profession. They outpace line of duty deaths in every first responder profession. That's a problem. And mostly we're aware of that. It's just really hard to change institutional behavior over time. And so we do try to get in and do wellness topics. So we try to talk about, you know, how your body responds to trauma, what to expect, how to offset those things. We try to at least once a year get in and say, hey, here's how your sleep system works. Here's how you work with it. Here are the things to think about in terms of how to improve your sleep if you're having difficulty and just how to keep your sleep healthy if you're not. Those are typically very well received types of trainings. We try to also do wellness training on alcohol use and how to moderate that. We try to do trainings on how to offset the constant fight or flight reactions that they get through, you know, relaxation activities and things that they can do to help offset those things. Again, sometimes there's a huge stigma still in our first responder agencies about mental health. And so we've got some that we've worked with 10 years and things have been going really well. And then all of a sudden a new person moves into a position of power and all those services are cut out. And that's really frustrating to watch and to watch them backslide and to try to explain to them, like, you're not helping. And their bottom line is always, well, we have all this training that we're required to do. And this just isn't high on our list. And it's like, Well, I understand that. And there are definitely a lot of things pulling at their budgets and their attention. But if it doesn't matter how physically fit or how well trained they are, if they can't function from an emotional standpoint, it's a catch-22, right? They're going to be just as impacted if their mind's not in the right spot as they are if they're missing a physical skill. But it's really hard to get some of our agencies to recognize that and to use that. We're not saying it's more important than anything else. We're just saying it's also important. And we would really like for those things to be consistently done. So some of them do pretty well and try to do it regularly. Others, it's, you know, we have to beg and plead to get in. And even then it's minimal.
Right. Wow. Now you're reminding me of a situation where I tried to raise the topic of shift work sleep disorder with an organization that works around the clock, and they routinely have people who they find, you know, sleeping on the job type of thing. And so I tried to, you know, offer up, maybe we should have just some, like you're talking about, basic education, basic screening, make people aware. Maybe they do have shift work. And the response that I got, unfortunately, is the bureaucratic one that you're talking about.
Yeah.
Oh, you mean the lazy ones?
Right.
And it's like, well, no, I don't mean the lazy ones. I mean the ones with shift work sleep disorder that you call the lazy ones.
Yeah. Well, that's so hard for them. And I see this specifically the majority of the time in our police organizations. There are so many officers in disciplinary status. And when you look at the factors of what's going on in that incident that they're being disciplined for, it's almost always mental health, or a large component of it is influenced by, you know, sleep disorder, mental health, things that aren't being treated, trauma exposure, and they don't have a way to recognize that. They don't have a way to address it. So everything falls into discipline, which is very frustrating.
Yeah. Wow. So when you go out and do some of these educational talks, have you ever had people first become aware that they had an issue and then come to you for help?
Yeah, actually, that's how we keep engagement with our organizations, is that we try to get in at least once a year, because usually that's a huge bump. And then we'll see a bunch of people coming in after the training, working on skills, things like that. Then it dies off a little bit over time. So then we push to get back in. And of course, they get frustrated because they're like, well, every time we do this, then it becomes more expensive. And I'm like, yeah, for a short period of time, but also you're getting healthier officers or healthier firefighters. And that's what we want. And now that we've been with a lot of our agencies for 10 years or so, they've seen the pattern and seen the benefit long term. And most of them have actually gone back and increased. Most of our contracts, we started with like 6 visits per year for each employee. And now several of them have gone back and said, you know what, we're taking those limits off. We just want them to come in as often as they need, because they can see the benefit that there are less folks in disciplinary status. There are less folks, you know, having problems and leaving their positions because they're actually attending to these things before they become bigger issues. And I think that's the unfortunate part of our medical system right now. We wait till everything's in a disease state and then it's harder to fix. And if we can be proactive about these things, we can keep people utilizing services a lot differently and frankly, a lot less, because they already know what to do.
Right, right. Well, so in our last minute or so here, can you share with us, can you think of one of your favorite stories where someone came in with some sort of real crisis and you were able to help them and it turned out to be a good news story?
Yeah, well, actually, it's a funny one, too. It's a sleep one. So I had a veteran who was also a firefighter come in, and, you know, he'd had exposure to every type of trauma you can imagine, war type trauma, as well as just the things they see in firefighting and whatnot. And he had not slept for years, literally years. And so we put him on the protocol, started going through some things with him. And it came down to, honestly, what he was eating, which was super funny, because we do try to teach them, like, don't eat a heavy meal right before bedtime, but, you know, shift workers, they eat when they can. And so we got down to, you know, we go step by step through everything that we're having him work on, and everything was right in line. And I get to the very last one. I'm like, okay, are you having a snack before bed? Oh yeah, I have a snack every night. Well, what do you have? 2 corn dogs and some fries.
Okay. Wow.
Yeah, that's not a snack. That's not a snack. Snack's the thing, like a granola bar or peanut butter or a cup of milk or whatever. So we got that switched around, and literally his issue went away pretty quickly. It was just that he was eating such a heavy meal. His body was working on digesting and it was disrupting his sleep.
Oh my gosh.
Super funny, but just one of those things that sticks with you because you're like, yeah, that's not a thing.
Well, at least that's a good news story, a simple fix and everything's good after years. Wow.
That's the thing with sleep, though. Oftentimes it is a very simple fix, and it's just that it's not intuitive. Sleep is not intuitive. The things that we think are going to fix it oftentimes make it worse, and it usually is a very simple thing that has to shift for that sleep to improve.
Right, right. Wow. All right. Well, that's a great way to end up and wrap up the show. This has been Dr. Kelly Dardine. We've talked about first responders and sleep. I want to thank you all for listening to Sleep Science Today. Don't forget to visit www.sleepsciencetoday.com, where you can find all of our other podcasts and you can find the YouTube channels. You can actually watch as we talk. So we look forward to seeing you next week on a new episode of Sleep Science Today. Dr. Dardine, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You have been listening to Sleep Science Today, your number one sleep authority.
Sleep Science Today.